This is Dick Buescher, and the subject is our partnership in creation, urgency and hope, which is the closing session of the retreat oriented around finding God in the wilderness. Let me take us on a short review of what we've achieved so far and discussed to give focus on this morning's discussion, and it's my intention that we will have ample time for discussion among us, particularly since it's the closing session, and to get some individual perspectives on what's happened here and what we do with it all. Scott opened with an emphasis on the current world environmental crises being based on an estrangement from our souls, humankind's estrangement from our own souls, defining soul as the essence or nature of humanity, and that we have disproportionately projected ourselves and the emphasis of the essence of our humanity outwardly, and the need to get that back into proportion, and in the inward concentration of our attentions to our own soul, to our nature, as being the first step toward embracing a world environmental crisis. And that one way to find ourselves, to examine that inner self, reorient our attentions to where it belongs in balance with outward attention, is to return to an appreciation of nature and a communion with nature. And nature, of course, representing the fruits of creation and God. I carried that to a discussion with you and an examination in the forest of the ecological, personal, and spiritual relationships, deep spiritual relationships, that exist between humanity and creation. And I hope I give you some insight on the need to intensify the application of all your senses when you are in a wild setting, so that in fact you just do not pass through and leave footprints and take really nothing with you. The essential need to concentrate your senses on what you see, smell and hear, what you examine, what you can interpret and discover that is humbling, edifying, uplifting, that begins to give us some perspective on what is truly important and those many commercial things in our life which we have placed so great an importance on, which have really rather small importance relative to the power of nature. Now, you'll remember I emphasize that we're not talking about gentle nature here. We're talking about the full aspect of the natural world, which happens in mighty ways, and that earthquakes and floods and great fires are not bad, not evil. They are essential. They're essential elements. They are a demonstration of the power of God, and they are elements that keep the system working. Al, I think, gave us very serious food for thought of the crises in which we have participated in placing this world in, and he gave us a clear picture of the connected nature of the problem that industrial society has made for itself. Even as we apply industrial solutions to industrial problems, we create more problems, for example. He demonstrated, I think, pretty clearly that our institutions have failed to embrace the problem. The most recent, the Congress of the United States, in trying to find a way to balance the budget, quickly dismissed a tax on gasoline because it was politically unpopular, and yet we all know one of the greatest motives for us to do what we should do willingly and don't, to conserve is our pocketbook. And a very small action, really, in the scheme of things, but would have been a positive action by one of our institutions, the Congress. We walked away from that one. Maybe they'll walk back to it as they struggle. I think what Al did for us more than that, it'd be very easy to cast Al into that mental image we get of the figure that strolls the world and said that the end is near, in flowing robes. And if you hear that from Al, then you didn't hear him at all. Because you'll remember he struck a chord of hope. But I think what he did most importantly, when he shared with us that it's really in the last 2 years that he in his own life has begun to be very seriously knowledgeable and aware of the enormity of the problem we face, that he modeled the behavior that we should all adopt. He has not been a voice and does not portray himself as a voice that's been crying for a long time to deaf ears. He was ready to admit with us that, like us, he has been a part of the deafness. And he has been listening. He is knowledgeable. He modeled for us awareness and personal responsibility. So where do we go from here? To capture something out of these few, very few hours that we spent together in our lives, and address this question for a final time, and address also, ultimately, the personal finding of God in the wilderness. Is it an urgent problem? Is it a crisis? Let me read from a Joseph Crutch, a very short passage, which I think puts some focus, at least for me, and I think perhaps for you. And then I'm going to invite your answers to that question. Is it urgent? Is it a crisis? The condition of the world environment. Crutch says, "It is by contact with living nature that we are reminded of the mysterious, non-mechanical aspects of the living organism. It is by contact with nature that we begin to get, even in its lowest forms, a sense of mystery, the independence, the unpredictableness of the living as opposed to the mechanical. And it is upon the recognition of that element in man, or women, which he shares with all living creatures, that any recognition of his dignity has to be based. And I sometimes fear that if we continue to act as though humankind were machines, they may actually, in the end, become something very much like machines." And I think perhaps that is not so far from where I see us having found ourselves, that in our sense of greed for the better way of life, quote unquote, the possession of the material, and we all share that we have found ourselves in this very luxurious civilization that we live in, while others have little to nothing. We have become more machine-like than human, and that's a reversal that must take place. But is it a crisis? What are your answers to that question? Is it urgent?
Well, anything that threatens to deprive us of the air we breathe is a crisis.
I would say so.
Most terrible proportions.
Clearly. Anyone else?
What's frightening to me is all this has happened in the last 100 years or so. We've gone so far, and we don't know what's going to happen. It's just no way to tell.
I think it's a crisis because it's so difficult to reverse. People do not understand how quickly things do run out. We're taking all this out of the savings bank, and in some respects, there's no way to bring it back in again. So when America was quote discovered unquote by Europeans, it was this enormous savings bank of wood, all kinds of wood, all kinds of coal, all kinds of soil in the Midwest, which is absolutely pitch black because it had been there for I don't know how many tens of thousands of millions of years, just developing humus, whatever. And the resources were just being used at a faster rate than it could possibly ever be restored. And England at that time had pretty much burned up Sweden's in the first industrial revolution. And we did the same thing to New England. It's not easy to replace all that sort of thing. And people don't understand that in time, when these things begin to run out, the realization will be too late. It's like it goes on.
Yeah, we have applied a terrible efficiency to the destruction of healthy ecosystems. Any other thought? Jim?
And Berlin, for the last century, they have said things are desperate but not tragic. And in Vienna, for the last 100 years, they have said things are tragic but not desperate. I work both sides of those equations. And the power of recovery of the Earth is still amazing to me. And as a sort of a halfway Texan, I was just absolutely worried to death about the Mexican gusher in the Gulf of Mexico. And I was surprised how quickly natural processes took care of that terrible tragedy. And I think the powers of recovery are still fairly good. Many years ago, I showed Al Pitcher a cartoon from the New Yorker where a character in sandals says, "Prepare to meet thy doom." And a bystander says, "Oh no, that's an environmentalist." That's an environmentalist. Religion is much more upbeat these days. That cartoon was 1968.
Right.
It might well be worthwhile remembering, however, that if war is drawing from the bank at 10 times the replenishment rate, regardless of the fact that the Earth is actually very durable and can bring itself down, it's also true that when that withdrawal stops, just as we're coming up to the limits of our ability to deficit spend, if that comes to a sudden stop, then society as we know it not just kind of comes to a halt, it starts to disintegrate and creates enormous new problems all on its own, because there was a reason, or there was something you consumed with that other 9 parts. And when that 9 parts can't be distributed, there's going to be a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I think John's and Jim's answer to the questions that urgent is a crisis are really answers to the question, is it too late? The answer to that question, and therefore no hope. The answer to that question, I think, is no. The might of natural processes is humbling for the very reasons as you're stating. It has enormous capability to heal. And I've seen it in my lifetime in micro parts of this globe and in the forests that I've worked in. But it needs our help, because it suffered our help to get the condition it is. And so there is urgent need. I want to move across from that then to the basic question of this morning's discussion, then: is there hope, and where do we find it? I see us having some personal choices, very clear personal choices in this. The first one, of course, is personal, to clean up our own act. And we got a lot of that from Al, and he continues to distribute, like the author of the book, 101 Ways to Save the Environment, which has had enormous populist acceptance as far as the purchase of the book. One has to question, you know, whether if every purchaser follows the lead, then in fact it's been a mighty message. But there's a fadism in all of this, and I think we have to remain alert to that. And there's a fadism always in ourselves as we begin to embrace some new thought or movement or concept. It cannot be that. It has to be deep, it has to be a personal commitment, and it has to be a life commitment. I'm a great believer in modeling wanted behavior. I think that scripture is full of the rejection of the hypocrite for very good reasons. When we hear noble messages from people who would acquire nobility, we often, and certainly the critical media and the investigative reporter Jim likes so well, is quick to find flaws in their garment, and as they should. I don't believe that, and that's why I'm impressed with Al, is that Al models his message, and he intends to dedicate his remaining years to doing something about the problem he recognized. And so I think that on a personal basis, that's one of the most important things that we have to accept, is that we have to model wanted behavior. There is enormous power in peer pressure. another thing that, and I've applied that observation through my life as a forest administrator, that the passage of regulation after regulation after regulation does not clean up the act of the American people in the national forest, and therefore we don't pass a lot of regulations. And I would contrast us with the National Park Service that seeks that course and then wears guns on their hips as a result, because if you have regulations, you have to enforce them. Our approach has been to emphasize the personal ownership of all the people of the United States in the national forest, which is a nice thought, but it carries a heavy responsibility with it. If in fact it is your front yard and backyard and not my national forest, then you have personal responsibilities to it. And that means that we, the administrator, can carry that message, but only if we model the wanted behavior. That's what Smokey Bear was all about, by the way, to model wanted behavior, and that is care with fire in the woods. The no trace camping that is taught here for us by Holden, and by a lot of other organizations, individuals, that when you enter wilderness, you leave only footprints, and we hope take spiritual uplifting with you when you leave, is another effort to model wanted behavior. I tell our wilderness rangers every spring in our training sessions that they are neither cop nor teacher. They're not out there to enforce rules. They're not out as a primary purpose. They're not out there to teach the heathens how to behave in the wilderness because they're an expert. Indeed, they may not be. Many visitors are more expert than our young wilderness rangers who are learning to live there. Indeed, their job is to be a model, that their camp has to be in the most environmentally correct place. They should always carry a tool and work on the physical wilderness with respect for it. They should not make contacts, as I tell them, but they should be contacted by those that want to, and those that don't are free to be free of a bureaucrat in the wilderness. Model wanted behavior and to be a coach, even when contacted, not teach, not take a lofty position, the sage on the stage, we call it here at Holden, but instead to coach out of people those things that are in people, much as a coach of a professional athletic team does, recognizing each athlete as a superior athlete to himself. He coaches out of that a collective success through coaching techniques, not teaching. And so I think all of us can take on that power of peer pressure when in fact we model wanted behavior and we realize that our children do respond even when we're frustrated and think they don't. They respond perhaps more to our deeds than our words. And they recognize in us and in teachers and pastors and everyone else who has influence on their lives, they look for behavior as much as listen to words. We find peer pressure a powerful tool in getting behavior accomplished on the national forest in terms of horse patrols for horsemen. They'll look to fellow horsemen much more quickly than they will to us during the high hunt to clean up what was an extreme environmental problem within wilderness. We enlisted the help of horse groups, trained them. They by their behavior, trained their fellow recreationists. So peer pressure exhibited by our personal commitment is step one. Then beyond that, you look to the power of the group. And I have, I have witnessed, you have witnessed in this society of ours, that things can be changed by individuals that collect into strategic action. I'll read a quote that contains both of these, by the way, which taken in juxtaposition of their time are interesting to me. But this is Austin, baptized into the wilderness, an examination really of the Christian teaching of John Muir as well as the environmental teaching. In our pluralist society, strong secular organizations are essential to promote experience with nature and coordinate political action to defend nature's interests. The Sierra Club, the organization expression of John Muir's legacy, has been magnificently effective I hope every Christian joins such a group as part of an environmental witness. However, social action and environmental protection do not encompass all of Muir's legacy. The Sierra Club has adopted a motto from Henry David Thoreau, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." Muir preferred to say, "In God's wildness lies the hope of the world." Muir's message, while never sectarian, was fundamentally religious. Preservation is essential, but beyond preservation is the hope of communion and delight, sensuous and spiritual experience. Wilderness is sacramental. It can help us meet God. The very theme of this retreat. So, getting our energies collected, and I think since my last 4 years of being closer associated with the Wilderness Program than the first 20-some, in which I had an administrative relationship, it struck me how powerful a Christian environmental movement across the world can be, and it has started. I suspect right now it's my greatest hope for us to reverse the trend that we've set in place, that in fact we transcend the sectarian arrangement of our worship of God when we unite in this obviously universal cause, that Christians say enough is enough, that they first change their own behavior, and that means model wanted behavior again, and then that we work to change the institutions responsible to make it happen, be they industry, government, or whoever, or the media. I think that my greatest hope lies in that success.
I am a very ardent amateur student of the origin of Christianity, and Christianity, and from my view, aside from the miraculous one, for two reasons. It reached out where individual behavior was changed. But I think one of the biggest reasons that Christianity won was the local bishops. They were powerful people. And Christianity, everybody from Gibbon to the Christian historians say that Christianity was a church within, was a state within a state. And a friend of mine who was a Jewish psychologist studied the Germans, and he said that anti-Semitism in Germany was a tricky deal. Not all Germans were anti-Semitic. And even after the Night of Crystal, when they had a rampage against Jewish shops, that most ordinary Catholic and Lutheran factory owners did not throw Jews out of their factories. They knew them as people and eye to eye. But they were obedient to the law. And when the Nazi government made a law to throw Jews out, only then did they throw them out. When there was supposedly this great, and so I am feeling that there's a slight analogy to the early church. There needs to be the equivalent of strong laws for good, as the German strong laws only then removed the Jews from factories and companies and stores. There needs to be the equivalent of strong bishops, and of course, like in early Christianity, a changed behavior that went through all the spectrum of society. I believe that there's always a lacking in the strong bishop equivalent in a lot of our thinking.
Others? Yeah.
In the village that I live in, which the economy of which is basically logging and a little mining and tourism, and there are a half a dozen churches ranging from Anglican, Catholic, through the United Church of Canada, through some kind of Pentecostal community church, to the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Maranatha Church. I have the feeling that the more traditional churches are more open to environmental concern, and that the more fundamentalist churches are less open, and that there is unfortunately probably also a generational difference here. That is to say that the younger people who are still involved in the economy of logging and trucking and so on might tend to be in the Pentecostal or the Jehovah's Witnesses and so on. This is the problem I see.
Mm-hmm.
Those that are right on the scene are interested in preserving their jobs.
Yeah.
And the elderly, we live in the same village. The elderly in the more traditional churches are so elderly that they don't have the energy left to do too much propagation of the environmental issues. They're just struggling to keep on their feet physically.
Anybody here from a metropolitan? Well, yeah.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah, please do.
Thanks. As I listen, what keeps running through my mind is that I feel that, and this is, it's so overwhelming, I think a whole consciousness needs a change of the people, our religion. For so long, Christianity has separated itself from creation. And even as we begin to educate ourselves, I think that's only a minute step towards the right direction, but to experience it, our society tells us to go out in the woods and sit for 5 hours is a waste of time. What have you done with your life? As opposed to a Native American, think that would be the most critical thing a person could do. Our consciousness is different, we're productive oriented, and we're separate from creation. And we call the earth our mother, and I think we need to experience that, to really know that the earth is our mother. And so I don't know. I do believe there's hope, but I think that's been an incredible awakening.
I appreciate that, Brian. Brian's not planted here as my shell, but you lead me almost perfectly into something I wanted to read for you, because I agree with you. There can be a terrible superficiality to this until we make that basic return to a realization between the relationship, I think, with the natural world and the world that we created. Listen to these words by Thomas Berry. Our problem is, of course, the problem of recognizing the primacy of the natural world and its spontaneous functioning in all that we do. As with our earth in all its processes, so with the human community, there are inner, spontaneous, all-pervasive forces present which are gradually responding to this integral functioning of the total system. What we need, what we are ultimately groping toward, is a sensitivity required to understand and respond to the psychic energies deep in the very structure of reality itself. Our knowledge and control of the environment is not absolute knowledge or absolute control. It is a cooperative understanding and response to forces that will bring about a proper unfolding of the earth process if we do not ourselves obstruct or distort these forces that seek their proper expression. I suggest that this is the ultimate lesson in physics, biology, and all the sciences, as it is the ultimate wisdom of tribal peoples and the fundamental teaching of the great civilizations. If this has been obscured by the adolescent aspect of our earlier scientific and technological development, it is now becoming clear to us on an extensive scale. If responded to properly with our new knowledge and our new competencies, these forces will find their integral expression in the spontaneities of the new ecological age. To assist in bringing this about is the present task of the human community. I think those words, at least for me, describe that unity that has to exist between our understanding and respect for natural processes and our operational and functional part of being within those processes and not without. We have followed a path since the industrial age, at the very least, in which we have set ourselves apart. The very thing that Scott emphasized in the beginning, and that outward expression without making the inward balance of contemplating where we fit in all that scheme, and that we have to respect natural forces. They are paramount. He talks of the primacy, and they are primus. Barry, I'm going to continue on using Barry as a guide because I find him as lucid on the subject, really, as anyone I've read, and obviously probably because he also coincides with thoughts I've had of my own experiences. He has written a 7-point agenda for the ecological age. I'm going to brush the high points as I see them. Recommend that if you seriously want to pursue the question, this is a good place to pursue it. He calls it an ecological age, and I call it the age of ecology. We've had lots of ages, industrialization, enlightenment, and all the rest, and I think we have entered, and we must succeed in an age of ecology, the linkage of all life and the recognition of that. And that's his very first of 7 points, is that human technology should function in an integral relationship with Earth technologies, and that was the point of that passage I just read to you. It is not an abandonment and going back to living in the cave, and we're not going to do that, nor was that a particularly good life. But it is to recognize the power of the technologies that we have are a part of the solution. They have been the problem. The second is that we must have a clear understanding of the order of magnitude of changes that are needed. We're not concerned here with just minor adaptations in fixing things up. Don made the point that it has been an accelerated and concentrated process in less than 100 years that have put us in the difficult straits we find the environment to be in. That it is, and Al expressed it so well, it is a great magnitude of change that is needed, not subtle little adjustments. His third point is that sustainable progress must be progress for the entire Earth community. So long we have isolated the resources of the world and coveted them in this nation, that we cannot fix the problem in one place. If we have learned nothing else, the clean air, the clean water, the utilization of scarce resources on a world basis where we rip off another nation's resources and then term them a member of the third world, that it is an entire Earth community problem, and progress can only be made there. It is almost frustrating to think of how a majority of the Earth armed community has come together not for the noble purpose of rescuing the people of Kuwait, but of rescuing our oil, our right to oil, our collective right to oil and to profits from oil. That's not the kind of bonding in the Earth community that Barry envisions or I envision. That fourth, that our technologies need to be integral. They need to take care of the waste products they produce, first and foremost. You heard that from Al, that the integration has to take place at the technological level, at the production level. It is not just applying technology to someone else's problem. Every single product that's produced has to reckon with the need to recycle the side products of that. Think of nuclear energy, that great hope that we cast up for ourselves when we said, well, this will cure the problem. We don't have to dam the rivers. We don't have to burn fossil fuels. We will not utilize the petroleum products of the world. We'll just go to this wonderful power of the atom without, of course, deciding what we're going to do with the side products. And so we've been producing and producing and producing, killing waste without a place to put it, and wondering in whose backyard we should put it, and looking at some rather interesting places to do that, like Indian reservations. So an integration of technologies to deal with the products of technology. His fifth is the need for a functional cosmology, and it's Brian's point, I really believe, that we need a sense of reverence, such as we find with the great naturalists, or such as we find with some of the foremost scientists of our times, scientists such as Freeman Dyson, Sir Bernard Lavelle, Brian Swinn, that without that reverence for nature, that ultimate respect, that understanding communion with nature, not just going out there for a visit, having good thoughts, making our heart happy, and returning to our place of problem, but to bringing that respect for nature to our place of living at all times. His sixth is that nature is violent as well as benign, and we've studied that. I've shared you my thoughts and mirrors. Our technologies have a defensive role to play. That the forces of nature, be they Mount St. Helens or great fires, hurricanes such as Hugo, those small little creatures, the termites that can do away with almost any building we build, given a chance, all forces of nature that I don't quite like his word defensive because of my nature, but in fact, I think that it's respect. It's respect for those, and that we design our lives and our and the things of our lives that understand those. We have a phenomenon in this nation called the wildland-urban interface. The greatest reason that we're highly concerned now about large forest fires is they're burning up our homes. Well, the only reason they burn up our homes is we build them in a place that they will burn up when the forest catches on fire. I stood on a butte, Lava Butte, in Bend, Oregon, at midsummer this year with forest supervisor, and we were discussing the creation of a national monument in Oregon to set aside a wonderful piece of volcanic history for interpretation, much as we did St. Helens. But we turned to look at the developments that were going on right in front of us on a butte on the edge of Bend. And I could see a fire scar on that butte that was a fire I fought when the area was undeveloped. About 20 years ago, and it burned to the Bend city limits, almost burned the Forest Service Research Lab 20 years ago. In those intervening 20 years, that very popular tourist and recreation community has developed two-thirds of that butte into $200,000 to $300,000 homes. About 40 of those homes burned this summer. We're not talking Southern California anymore. It happened in Spokane, it happened in Missoula, it happened in the South. Well, why? Because we cannot respect the need for nature to have those great natural processes like fire occur with as a part of the functional part of the ecosystem, and we build obstacles to their path and then decry the fact that the fire burned the obstacles. That is not playing a respectful role, or as Barry says, a defensive role to nature. We have to leave nature room to function. The seventh is last, is that our new and healing technologies need to function within a bioregional context. And I think this is an important concept, that we organize the world and drew lines in the world in a socio-political manner. I mean, there's what reason do we have between the boundaries between Canada and the United States, or between Oregon and Washington, or between the Wenatchee National Forest and private land? We have geopolitical boundaries that make no natural sense whatsoever, and in fact, almost always cross the bioregional natural organization of the world. And I think it's a particularly sensitive insight by Barry to realize that to take the world problem and manage it, bioregionality is essential. And because resources occur there, like climates occur there, the populations that collect there for natural reasons. We buy and sell scenery every day in the United States. We buy and sell climate every day in the United States. We buy and sell adjacency to recreation opportunities. This is how Boeing spends less money on salaries in Seattle than their competitors do in Huntsville, Georgia. If you're from Georgia, I'm sorry. But the quality of life that's available in the Puget Sound area is saleable in a reduced salary in a world of high competition for high technology scientists. And I know this because my brother-in-law runs a research lab for Boeing. And they are competitive not by offering more money, but by putting out beautiful brochures that express the desirability of the environment and its opportunities that it affords. So we are bioregionally organized in the world, but we are geopolitically bounded. I think we have to overcome that. We have to work across international boundaries and across state boundaries, and we have to respect and take advantage at the same time of the products of nature within a bioregional organization. That's going to take some doing, but it's happening. It may happen when we realize that the situation is desperate. I would like to think we're more intelligent than that, and we can do it earlier. I thought I'd share with you, on a personal basis, something that's small in the scheme of the world environments, even bioregionality, though some of these things do focus on that aspect. But things going on in the Forest Service, there is an environmental revolution going on in the Forest Service. And it virtually has succeeded. The greatest change in the Forest Service that took place previous to this was we were organized in 1905 to protect the forest from fire, from timber barons, from miners running amok, from grazers that were overgrazing the range. And so Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot got together and said, hey, we got to stop this. They created the National Forest System, which is about 190 million acres or an area the size of France, and is in about 35 states of the Union. So a huge set aside of publicly owned lands for the purpose of Christian utilitarianism, by the way, multiple use. Early definition was protect and then use wisely. And this was the driven purpose of Gifford Pinchot, who had many debates over this with Muir, who took a very different Christian view of what world resources were about and what the nation's resources were about, and championed preservation more than use, again under a Christian principle. But we made our greatest change when we moved from the era of protection, and you have the image of the ranger and the lookout and riding his horse through the mountains and catching the bad grazers, and indeed wore a gun, by the way, some real bad looking hombres. And we moved from that to begin to deliver the nation's needs in wood and water and almost incidentally recreation, and then became the largest provider of outdoor recreation in the world without even trying or even putting in any great attention on it. We began to be the producer of commodities in the 40s, and most particularly when the boys came home in 1946 and they needed a house and a home and the baby boom needed to be accommodated, and we delivered. As we say, we got out the cut. And so then, and there was great political and social reward in doing that at the time. The Congress of the United States funded a cut larger than the Forest Service recommended in the last decade each year, because it was working. It was income to the Treasury and then helped them with their problems. It was wanting to spend more than they made. And so there was strong social and political acceptance of that role of the Forest Service until about the 1970s, when young people and others, the owls of the world, came along and said, wait a minute. This isn't quite right. We don't like the results of that kind of management. It's having serious impacts on our environment, and we want change. And the Forest Service had a slow ear to that message. There were a few of us, and I like to think I'm a part of that, that changed then and became a strong voice for change. I dedicated my energies to the making of wilderness, and changing practices on the ground as I could affect them on this forest when I was deputy and supervisor, but a very small contribution. The whole workforce hadn't got the message yet. and the leadership of the Forest Service definitely didn't have the message yet. And so we managed with the old ethic beyond the emergence of the new one, and there came the conflict, owls versus jobs, old growth, preservation versus harvest. So what's going on today? There are three initiatives that are underway, one of which I started myself. His turn, somewhere here we got an eraser.
Up on top of the
board. Oh, there it is. Thank you. Always mess the other.
Maggie's drawers.
Exactly. Just simply people serving people. And I'll tell you how this came about. It's really interesting. And it's now gone national, or is going national 2 weeks from now in a major conference with the leadership of the Forest Service, in which I'm involved back east. We started a few years ago a program called the HOST program. And its purpose was to treat you folks better when you came to see us. From its inception, it was well intended, but from its inception, that word bothered me. The reason that word bothered me, of course, is that if I come to see you in your home, you host me, because it's your home. Well then, you could only draw the conclusion that the Forest Service saw the forest as ours, and you were the visitor, and I was going to be nice to you because you were a visitor. And I say, that didn't cut it. That in fact, I suspect that we should have called it the servant program. But since this society has demeaned the meaning of that most noble of human activities to serve others, and demeaned it to something just above slavery, we didn't want to call it that, and host certainly sounded better, but it still bothered me. And so in this region, I got about four smart people together, and we started the thing called People Serving People. And we said, no, it's people's land, and we serve them, count on you. The concept of people serving people now is that we serve you by being responsive in the care and stewardship of the land and every activity, be it a timber sale or the construction of a road, or any other thing that changes the environment. So the concept of service is way beyond just being a nice host and ensuring a happy visit. It goes way beyond that. It goes to our basic responsibilities, which are caring for the land and serving people. That's our self-recognized mission, and people serving people is replacing host. That's a philosophical change that I think is essential. But let me get to the important ones. You'll hear this because it's now in the halls of Congress. New perspectives and, not or, new forestry. And there is a current danger that they become equated. Let me tell you first what new forestry is. The simplest, and it is a grassroots movement. It's not from the top down. Everything that happens in the Forest Service worth happening is a grassroots movement because we are inversely organized. I see the top of the Forest Service as the rangers and their people, those people that frontline with the ground and with the people that visit the forest. And at the bottom of the Forest Service is the chief, who holds it all up like Atlas. And all of us that are not on the front line anymore, as I have not, have worked down in the organization rather than up. I call it the lowerarchy. As we've worked into the lowerarchy, we become support people for the people that carry out the mission who are on the top of the outfit. But new forestry then is growing in the grassroots of the Forest Service, and it's growing beautifully. And what it is a move from that dominance of nature approach that we know best. We went to forestry school, came away with an understanding of the utility of forests, that a good tree is a wasted tree, that the value of a forest and the value of the product of creation is to serve man, humankind, by structures and newsprint and the rest, and that all we need to do is just cut them and replace them ad infinitum, and everything's swell. And that's the law of the land, by the way. Multiple use and sustained yield. That ignored the basic intimacy with natural processes and used human domination as a fundamental theme. That's what's being reversed. New forestry, the goal is to leave all ecosystems intact while extracting goods and services and amenity values, be they scenery or whatever. That an intact and operating ecosystem is essential. To me, as I told you the other day, that's the death knell of clear cutting. Because in fact, that's the death knell of clear cutting as a fundamental silvicultural tool. That in fact, you cannot do both in clear cutting, unless you are talking about single group selection. I suppose you could call that a clear cut, less than 2 acres. But much more than that, it's respecting that areas like riparian areas, where all life maximizes, deserve the greatest concentration of our attention when we design the things that happen there, be they campground or
timber sale. Riparian mean riverbank?
Riparian means all of the immediate influence land surrounding a riverbank. And thank you for the question, because I use language that I think is known and isn't. If you think about it, when I say all life concentrates here, all life needs water. All cultural resources are found there, because early humans needed exactly the same habitat requirements as we do. Deer, elk, the higher mammals, larger mammals, they're no higher. Insects, bird life, growth capacity, complexity of ecosystem all occur in the riparian, and needs our greatest respect, and in New Forestry understands that. So why is New Forestry not the same as New Perspectives? Let me demonstrate what I think is there's a continuing problem. This still is a separation of humans, or humankind, and the naturals. It concentrates science and then design on the natural. New Perspectives, which has emerged and is both grassroots and national, does this, and this is my simplest definition. I've seen all kinds of cute ones and intelligent ones and complex ones, but to me that's an equilateral triangle, even if I didn't draw it, so as I use it in symbolically, and it deals with three realities. It deals with the reality that indeed there are commodities out there. There are great values in that segment of God's creation called a forest. That there are indeed what are often called amenities or, I would say, spiritual values, be they scenery, wilderness, or whatever, the experience of wilderness, not wilderness in itself. And then there are lastly, of course, the ecological values of nature itself, which must be respected and had not been. And that, for me, equal consideration of the three have to take place. And so what I call it is a search as we plan, design, and execute. A search for compatibilities. Jim and I have had a couple of discussions here of how fantastic it is when you begin to see that many natural processes and human needs coincide if you avoid what I call the great profanities of our Forest Service language constraints. And trade-offs, which to me, is a very negative approach, and that's how forest planning took place, largely because it was done with a computer, and computers are not intelligent, as humans are, and they have to be told simple rules, add, subtract. And so, when you say maximize timber, you admit scenery as a constraint, that's obscene, or the needs of wildlife as a constraint on maximizing timber. And so, unfortunately, we took the inability of a computer to think and transferred it to the human mind when we wrote the forest plans that were required by Congress all over the United States in the last decade. And so I say no to this, and I say what it really is a search for compatibilities with the consideration it does not mean that each gets a third, but it means it gets equal consideration in the search. But the final decision for a piece of ground may be 100% on the side of ecological, and that would be if you make a wilderness, where the wilderness itself is preserved not as it exists, but as it will be. You preserve natural processes. The very idea of preserving old growth is hilarious to me. I told you my suggestion the other day that I wanted people to work on the preservation of ancient forests, foresters, instead of forests, because then I would be a direct beneficiary. And of course you can't do that, because I will die like all other humans, and so will old trees.
That's a variation of what we used to say: history doesn't repeat itself, but historians repeat each other.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so do trees. And that's the whole point. If you talk about preserving the ecosystem, and you understand the consequence of that, which is all those beautiful cathedral forests will fall down and be replaced by something else, and probably burn first in the process. If you understand those rules and champion preservation, as I do in the places where it's appropriate, then it's an intelligent act. If it's preservation of what exists there today, then of course it's an act of non-understanding of the rules of nature. But that's going on. That's going on in the National Forest, but it's also going on worldwide. The managers of other forests, we talked this morning, that we got our forestry from Germany and France. And that was the highly regulated, orchard-like, cut that natural, messy-looking place, make it nice and neat, get rid of all the stuff on the ground so the next time we come around it won't be in the way. And of course, we took all the nutrients of the life support systems for essential small mammals and insects and plants and fungus out of the forest and wondered why the next forest didn't grow so well, and then we added chemicals which took high energy, and so on goes the problem. So this is a reversal, an effort to reverse that. Dave?
Isn't it true that sometimes the preservation of the old growth is the preservation of the process?
Oh yes, that's the point. That's exactly my point, if I didn't state it well. That if you champion preservation of an ecosystem and understand that, because it's usually the beauty of the old growth that the majority of the people that champion the cause, and they talk of cathedral forests, which is always interesting to me. I do think of these mountains as my cathedral, and they have been that. They've supplanted for me a need to be internally in a church, to be in church. And
Dick, there's
a
man here that I think knows Greek. Would you tell us the root of the word ecology, which I think is Greek? And somebody long ago said it meant
oikos and logos. Oikos, house. Logos is a very pregnant word, of course. But it can also, it means word. The beginning was the logos word. Essentially, of course, it's care of the house.
Yeah.
Care of the house.
Right.
I would just want to make a comment here. This is looking at it from the perspective, I suppose, of especially agriculture. In 1976, we had a terribly dry year in much of the country, but especially in the Great Plains. Awfully hot, dry summer. And it was a disaster for a lot of people, especially farmers, but others suffer too, and the farmers do. But I was talking with a student from Northwestern Iowa, who is now a pastor. She's a pastor, in fact, in Sioux Falls, where we're from. And she was telling about her family. Her father had switched from the use of chemicals to organic farming. And what made him switch was that he had become very ill from applying these chemicals and had almost died. So while he had to work harder at it, nevertheless, he persisted at it. Well, in 1976 was this terribly dry summer, and she said, I went out to the neighbor's cornfield just across the road and cut off a piece of corn stalk in July, August perhaps it was, or early September, and it was dry and hard. And then I went back home and cut off a piece of cut off a corn stalk from Dad's farm, where he had used organic farming methods. And she said it was still moist. And I said, why in the world, you know, are we doing this? And she said, well, I think our county agents are products of institutions here that have been subsidized by big chemical companies.
You're right on.
Big brands and so on.
That's why Benjamin Franklin said we should select an old mistress. She may be withered in her limbs, but she has sap in the trunk.
There's a term. Yeah.
And you're very correct about agriculture. It's happening right in this, no. In, in the state over in the Palouse. Non-tillage agriculture done. And it's dirty farming. That is, we leave it looking messy. And they're the same term concurrently and without any communication between the two movements in the School of Agriculture and the practice of forestry on the HCM, which is experimental forest. They started calling it dirty forestry or dirty clear cuts, which in fact left the large woody material, the large standing material, and if it didn't exist, created it. And taking green trees and making them snags.
The New Testament, leave it for the gleaners. Yeah. The forest to come in.
So, yes.
We have tried to engage our local forestry management people in debate about the relative merits of clear cuts and various other modified versions of it. And they all say to a man something which appeals to my Scottish sense of neatness, which is slash and burn, you know.
Right.
But you've got to clean the forest floor because otherwise you're going to have insects. You're going to have the.
Yeah.
And we have been unable to come up with scientific arguments to rebut this.
They're in contact now, however, Canadian government is with the effort that's going on in New Perspectives in the United States.
Of course,
but they're a step behind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My experience, however, with Canadian professionals, and I've had a fair amount, and I mentioned some of it, is that they tend to poor mouth themselves. And well, you folks in the lower 48 really got your act together, and gee, we're still the frontier. And about 2 years later, we're trying to catch up with them. So I see some hope for you.
You think okay?
Because my experience has been that when they turn around sometimes more swiftly than we do.
You were talking about.
But we were there 5 years ago. Yeah. We're saying exactly
the same thing. You were talking about geopolitical boundaries and divisions and so on. And we were hopeful when the Free Trade Act was passed that minimum standards for Canadian manufacturing and forestry would be forced to come up to minimum standards in the U.S. and that hasn't happened yet, so we beseech you, if you have any influence at all, to suggest that perhaps it might be a good idea at government level to have the same standards for both countries, because it's foolish to have a good standard down here and a much lower standard 20 miles across.
I agree with you, and that's the third one. I said there were three that are going on. People serving people, new forestry, new perspectives, the difference between those, by the way, is that, and I didn't finish that, new perspectives
brings humans into the equation. New forestry is still biocentric. And I'm working with a group of PhD social scientists called the Social Consortium in Oregon State University, University of Washington, and Oregon State Forest Service Research in the Northwest, called the Social Science Consortium. And we're bringing humans into the equation, and so the anthropocentric doesn't exist, the biocentric doesn't, that in fact it's the fusion that Barry and everyone else that looks at the problem says is essential. And that's what New Perspectives is. It brings humankind into new forestry and adds the essential dimension. New Northwest Strategies, very succinctly, is an effort by the Forest Service to be a catalyst, not a leader, in helping the communities impacted by the misdirection that we've really applied to timber in the Northwest, to a lesser extent mining, but primarily timber, and the extraction of timber, have become dependent upon it, have created a lifestyle upon it, no fault of theirs, and I'm talking about the people, not the industry. It's plenty of fault of theirs. Co-opt with us. And so we feel a high moral obligation to help these communities find their way through this. And that doesn't mean train loggers to flip hamburgers at McDonald's. And it is not social engineering, as the industry is accused us of, because we'd probably be poorer at that than we are some of the other engineering we do. But it is, in fact, gathering with the communities as a catalyst, and importantly as a catalyst, not a, quote, federal leader, and helping them through this, helping find a way for a quality, sustain a quality of life, an essential quality of life, which may be quite a bit simpler than the ones that we have known. I think that's a part of it. And but understand the human impacts that are occurring today and will continue to occur in the Northwest and will occur in Canada, partly because the industry has had little regard for its employees, in my opinion, witnessed by the fact that while the cut was increasing in recent years, employment was going down because of major improvement in industrial processes, which limited the need for labor. So unemployment was occurring in the industry during the boom period as well as during the shrinking supply of logs. So an effort is underway, and I'm part of an organization in this one too, to work with individual communities in an individual manner, but collectively across the region, and for us the region is the Northwest. We believe it has to be across the Canadian border, many of us, that in fact we're dealing with the same ecosystem in many cases, and we're dealing with an exchange of resources. We're the biggest user of lumber from British Columbia, the United States. So those three efforts are underway, and to me, on a microcosm of the world's problems, show that at least some institutions are changing. There is strong congressional support for the two of the three of these. There'd be natural ones for people serving people. So we have time for some unconstrained, undirected discussion. Let me really close with Scott's and my, it appears, favorite commentator on wilderness and human relationship to wilderness, Sigurd Olsen. I looked and looked and tried to find an eloquent German, and I couldn't do it, so I'm still stuck with that Scandinavian. But you know any eloquent Germans? No, I don't want to get you started.
Sure, Nietzsche.
Yeah. But Sigurd was a marvelous figure in the wilderness movement. I was a part of it, and appreciated the words of Olsen, of the Miries, of Zonheiser, who wrote the words of the Act. A lot of really eloquent individuals, again, that made a difference. They made a difference, Aldo Leopold within the Forest Service, Bob Marshall within the Forest Service, some of us that came later. Individuals made a difference in the wilderness movement in the United States, which we've exported to Canada. I was one of two people in the United States that advised, at their request, the British Columbia government on the development of a of a wilderness system for British Columbia, and one now exists. Awfully small, but one exists, and they grow. I guarantee you, wilderness systems grow. Olson's words to end on. The intangible values of wilderness are what really matter. The opportunity of knowing again what simplicity really means. The importance of the natural and the sense of oneness with the earth that inevitably comes within it. These are spiritual values. They are, in the last analysis, the reasons for its preservation. So, realizing that, utilizing what we discussed and experienced here together, I do believe indeed that it is possible to find God and to find ourselves and the spirituality within us by utilizing that wilderness resource as a part of the human experience. But remember me not as a refuge, as a place to retreat to and then go back to our lives as we experience them, but rather to use it as a place of human growth, spiritual growth, so that we can translate what we learned there to our backyard, our office, the conveyance that takes us to work, wherever we are, recognizing that spirituality transcends the boundary between the wilderness experience and the urban experience or wherever you live.